The 17th Century Indigenous Critique of European Society.
They were scandalized, for example, by the extent of homelessness in European colonial towns. Living in the way of money, the way that money pervades human relationships, even within families, the tendency to obey one's superiors. So they object and find strange the way that hierarchy works in European societies, the fact that we have ranks and that you defer to people purely on the basis of status or of wealth. They found it quite alien, this idea that simply having more wealth than somebody else gives you power over them.
That's archaeologist David Wengrow. We spend the hour talking with him about the groundbreaking book he co-authored with the late David Graeber, The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. That's coming right up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We've all grown up thinking that the trajectory of human civilization proceeded from so-called primitive, egalitarian, hunter-gatherer societies to the invention of agriculture with more and more complex social class structures to the modern era of global capitalism with its inevitable hierarchies. The lesson seems to be, if you want civilization, you just have to put up with inequality and ever more social control by the powers that be. But is that really true? In The Dawn of Everything, my guest David Wengrow and his co-author, the late anthropologist David Graeber, say human beings have been far more creative in their social arrangements than conventional wisdom can fathom. For example, there have been highly complex and technologically advanced hunter-gatherer societies. There have also been radically egalitarian agricultural societies, like the ancient Mexican one at Teotihuacan. Others, like those in pre-Columbian North America, have flipped back and forth on a seasonal basis between ceremonial authoritarianism and everyday participatory democracy. Wengrow and Graeber's groundbreaking book lays out the case in fascinating detail that many other worlds are possible in human society. Things don't have to be the way they are because people are endlessly ingenious in devising the societies they want to live in. And they've been doing that for hundreds of thousands of years. One review called The Dawn of Everything a history book for the 99%. That was a nod to David Graeber, who was one of the original organizers of Occupy Wall Street, with the slogan, "We are the 99%. Graeber died suddenly in September of 2020. David Wengrow is professor of comparative archaeology at University College in London. Well, David Wengrow, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, the central theme in this book is that another world is possible. That for most of our existence as a species, people experimented with many forms of social structure, even alternating wildly different forms of self-organization within their own societies within the same year. Until it all went wrong, and we got locked into a kind of unimaginative straitjacket that's leading us to disaster. You ask in the book whether we can rediscover the freedoms that make us human. What are those freedoms?
We, in the end, came down upon the idea that we would try and define these freedoms as clearly as possible. We wouldn't just leave it as a series of scattered observations scattered throughout the book. We would try and bring this together and really really define what had emerged from our years of research. And the conclusion we arrived at was that there are three basic forms of freedom which have been common to many societies, maybe in most societies throughout history, but which have become very alien to us, to the extent that today we'd actually find it quite difficult to even imagine building a society on these three principles. And before I go through them, let me just say we're certainly not claiming that we've exhausted all the possibilities here. It's not a dogmatic kind of book in that sense. I'm sure there are other forms of freedom that one could talk about. But the three that kept recurring in our work and in the examples we were looking at were firstly simply the freedom to move away from one's surroundings, one's place of birth, one's home, one's family. Escape your surroundings, move away in the knowledge that your destination is going to be a welcoming one, a place where somebody will take you in, value, care for you, and so on. The second basic freedom that we identify is the freedom to refuse arbitrary commands, again, in a certain expectation of not being punished or evicted from your community, but of being listened to and debated. It's the basis of participatory democracy or consensus decision making. And the third basic freedom, which we found really to be predicated on the first two, is the freedom to actually reimagine, as you were just saying, just reimagine our social possibilities and redefine our social orders, rearrange our social structures, try different ways of living collectively. And those are the three that we focus on in the book, to the extent that at one point my co-author David Graeber, he thought of calling the book The Third Freedom. In the end, we decided it was a little bit obscure, maybe, or it might be misinterpreted. I think there was something in American political. Who had the four freedoms? There was a president who had the four freedoms, right?
Yeah, FDR.
Had the four. What were the four freedoms? I'm a bit ignorant about American politics.
Freedom from want. I don't know, actually, but I know freedom from want was one of them.
Freedom from want, yeah, right. That was important. So there you go. There's another example of a basic freedom that one could talk about. Those are the three that we define as important because we find examples in the book of whole social systems or even whole families of societies, civilizations built on these principles, which today, I think when we talk about freedom today, it's often in the sense of individual freedoms and personal freedoms, but the element of reciprocity, the element of care for the other, I think perhaps is missing in some of those what today are more widespread notions of freedom.
Yes, and it was exactly that pairing of liberty with care, mutual aid, that I found so interesting in this. In fact, that's what comes from, well, many societies, but you take up the figure of Kandiyarank.
Yeah. I mean, just on what you were saying before, I remember David in another publication, he used the analogy of children and the fact that the freedom of children, you know, the freedom to play, to experiment, try things out, is predicated on somebody caring for them. Otherwise, you know, we know what happens if kids run. My kids certainly used to, you know, run headfirst into the television or fall off a cliff or something. Somebody's looking out for them and caring for them. And it's the care that actually gives them the freedom to experiment, to play around, and to learn from their mistakes and to grow. And if you take that as an analogy for society as a whole, you know, one could ask, to what extent do our societies... are our societies able to take risks, to experiment without fearing absolute catastrophe, so that we can learn cumulatively from those experiments and grow as a society?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with archaeologist David Wengrow about the book he co-authored with David Graeber, The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. Yes, and I definitely want to unpack what you just said more a little bit later, but first, just to set the frame, you really contrast, I guess you'd say, the modern Western philosophy, perhaps originating in the 19th century, not even in the Enlightenment, actually, but, well, the 18th and 19th century. You contrast Rousseau and Thomas Hobbes and some of the thinkers that came after them. They're opposites to each other, but you actually do put them on one side of the ledger and contrast them with what you call the indigenous critique. So tell us what that indigenous critique is, where it came from, its influence on us, and Hobbes and Rousseau, why they're framed as so disastrous politically.
Well, Hobbes takes us way back to the English Civil War in the 17th century, and I'm not sure we'll find much of the indigenous critique in him, but for the 18th century, certainly, this is, at one level, it's a well-known phenomenon, and there's a big scholarly literature about these dialogues. It was a literary genre, a very important one in the Age of Enlightenment, where a European author would set themselves up in a discussion with an exotic figure, a person from another world, another civilization, or it might as well almost have been another planet in some occasions. These are completely fictional, made-up interlocutors. Sometimes it might be a Peruvian princess, or a Persian, or a Tahitian, or someone from deepest Oceania. The point is, it's somebody clearly from outside the sphere of European culture, who in the story, in the dialogue, is made to talk back at the European author, and often to voice criticisms of European civilization and European forms of behavior. And there's a huge literature in history, in post-colonial studies, about this romantic literary genre. And one might call those indigenous critiques, but they're quite different from what we're talking about in the book. They're very closely related, but they really are fictional characters, where essentially you have a European author having a dialogue with himself or herself through a kind of sock puppet, a fictional character who talks back at them. But what we're talking about in the book is a very specific historical episode which gave rise to one of those literary dialogues, but we argue that it is different in character, fundamentally different from the kind of purely invented, fictitious savages that I've been talking about. And these are the books of a French author and nobleman and traveler and soldier called the Baron Lahontan, published right at the start of the 18th century, which became incredibly popular. They were bestsellers in Europe. They actually inspired many imitations. So a lot of these fictitious dialogues I've been talking about were, in a sense, ripoffs of Lahontan's book, which was called Curious Dialogues with a Savage of Great Wisdom and Sense Who Has Traveled. And in his case, the savage interlocutor is a character called Adario. And historians recognize that Adario is not an entirely fictitious character. He is based, more or less loosely, on a real historical person, and a very important historical person, a very senior member of the Huron-Wendat nation in the Great Lakes region of Canada, which is where Lahontan spent many years as a soldier and an adventurer. He became fluent in native languages, Wendat and Algonquin. Lahontan was deeply embroiled in the indigenous societies of that region. And he was also at various points quite senior in the colonial government and quite close to the governor of that part of the colonies of what they then called New France. And in that mix of colonial settler groups and a complex array of Native American nations was this figure, Kandirong, who was the speaker of the Wendat nation. He was an accomplished warrior and diplomat, and we have a number of independent accounts which verify for Europeans and non-Europeans. He was simply an admirable figure, particularly for his intellect and his ability, his oratorical abilities, his ability to frame speeches of enormous wit and beauty and wisdom, to such an extent that the French governor at the time in the region used to invite Kandiyohanc to his table and host what we can only really describe as sort of pre-Enlightenment or proto-Enlightenment salons there at Fort Mackinac. We know this from observers like the Jesuit priest and historian Pierre de Charlevoix, who describes that Kandiyohanc would come to the table of the Comte de Frontignac as a guest of honor to provide a form of entertainment for Frontignac's officers. And there they would have these extended to and fro about the virtues of native versus French or European civilization, the meaning of money, marriage customs, all kinds of other things that would later appear in L'Hontan's book. So with L'Hontan, we have a very different situation to these purely imaginary, fictitious savages. But this is a point of contention, and we knew that writing this part of the book. We even anticipate in various parts of the book that we don't expect to have an easy ride with historians of the Enlightenment on this point, because what they've generally done is lump Kandiyohanc into the same category with all those imaginary savages, despite the fact that we do know all these facts about his life and about L'Hontan's life, which to us seems curious.
Indeed. But tell us, what was the central part of Kandiyohanc's critique of Western society?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things we do early on in the book is comparisons between things that Kandiyohanc or Addario says in the dialogues, critical things about Europe, and critical things that were voiced by many, many other indigenous peoples in broadly the eastern woodlands of North America, from Newfoundland down through the Great Lakes to upstate New York. And we have records of these things in sources like the Jesuit Relations and in the writings of Biard and Charlevoix. Now, these Jesuits were not romanticizing local people. They were trying to convert them, and they were often highly critical of them. But they also note that the local societies were even more critical of Europeans. And what we found is that there is an overlap. There's a consistency between things that appear in the speeches of Addario or Kandiyohanc and many of these other objections that were voiced by probably hundreds or thousands of other people about the way that the French and Europeans in general behaved to each other. They were scandalized, for example, by the extent of homelessness in European colonial towns. And it's worth remembering that quite a number of representatives of indigenous nations traveled to Paris and other European cities. It's quite likely that Kandiyohanc himself did, but we can't verify it 100%. But we know that a speaker of the Wendat Nation, which is what he was, did come to Europe. Homelessness, living in the way of money to the extent that Europeans do and still do, the way that money pervades human relationships, even within families, the tendency to obey one's superiors, coming back to our three freedoms. So these were societies which had certainly the second freedom, the right to disobey orders. In Huron Wendat societies of the time, nobody, not even chiefs, had coercive powers. And this is widely documented. And if you look at the authoritative anthropological works and ethno-historical works like Bruce Trigger's books on the history of the Huron Wendat, they comment on this fact that as the Jesuits put it, the chief's power was all in his tongue, not in his fists, by which they mean that if a chief wanted to engage people in some collective project, he had to do it by persuasion. So this it's simple. I mean, it's a very logical thing. There's only so many ways you can get people to do things. In this case, since there was no way to force people, what it meant was that there was a very highly developed culture of oratory and political debate and discussion and persuasion. And that's the milieu, really, out of which comes Kandirong. He's not a sort of isolated, miraculous thing. So they object and find strange the way that hierarchy works in European societies, the fact that we have ranks and that you defer to people purely on the basis of status or of wealth. They found it quite alien, this idea that simply having more wealth than somebody else gives you power over them. And also, a lot of the dialogues are about Christianity. We know that Kandirong himself was anti-Christian. It's one of the reasons why La Hontan seems to have got along with him. La Hontan had his own problems with Christianity or the form of Christianity that existed in the 17th century. So a lot of the material in the dialogues is Kandirong basically dissecting what he takes to be the odd and illogical features of Christianity, like the sheer number of different competing sects, or the stories of Christ, which he finds highly implausible. And it's funny because it's almost like it's the indigenous voice, which is the voice of the rational skeptic, the anthropologist, looking at these peculiar customs of people who believe that God came down to earth in the form of a man who nevertheless was so weak and powerless that he allowed himself to be crucified. And, you know, he's sort of logically dissecting all these tenets of the Christian faith as well. There's stuff about health and diet. There's stuff about divorce and sexual freedoms. It's an incredible sort of rampage through, and some of it's quite devastating, particularly on the subject of money.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. You're listening to my conversation with David Wengrow about the book he co-authored with the late, great David Graeber, The Dawn of Everything. You know, one thing that really interested me about this, about the society of Kandirong, and of course it was not alone in this, but well, maybe very peculiar in this sense, I guess, is that on the one hand, the height, the most horrible transgressive thing you could do is give orders to other people. On the other hand, dreams were so respected, had such a power, were so important in this society that if somebody dreamed of a desire, it was the obligation of somebody else to fulfill that desire,
to make their dreams come true.
Exactly. So talk about this, you know, it's a kind of dialectic in a way between individual liberty and taking care of somebody else.
Dreams may be the only area of life where you can almost give an instruction and it has to be obeyed, or at least one must be seen to be trying to fulfill the dream wish.
So what does this mean? Because what does it say about the tension between individual liberty and our responsibility to others?
I think it makes me think about other parts of the book where we talk about how, rather than coercive force being absent, it's kind of locked up in certain areas of life which prevent it from becoming everyday. They prevent it from spreading, becoming just a mundane feature of the way we behave to each other. Dreams would be one example of that. Ritual would be another. In the book, we talk about societies which had highly coercive systems, but they would perhaps only be set up in the context of a ritual performance. And then those powers, almost sort of play-acting powers, would seep away after the end of the ritual, or that might only be called into being on a seasonal basis, and then society flips back into a less coercive form. But I'm not sure that answers the question
Guess I'm wondering, that's those societies, but of course I was reading this book with what we can take away, and I think you were writing this book with what can we take away from this. So You know, what does this say about what can we take away from that idea of the interplay and the dialectic between individual liberty and our responsibility to each other?
Well, I think we tend to see these things now as being in opposition to each other. So a libertarian position tends to be seen as the assertion of freedoms, which in the absence of care for what that means for other people, arguably isn't really a social freedom at all. It's actually a form of domination. It's like refusing to wear your COVID mask. Say, well, I'm exercising my freedom. I might be doing terrible harm to the person next to me, or even to a close relative, but I'm being free. Well, yes, you're being free, but you're also imposing something potentially very serious on somebody else. Whereas the element of care, I guess it also must relate somehow, I think, to the way that freedom has become opposed in political discussions to socialism and even communism. The idea that these things are somehow at odds with each other. With the Wendat and other cases we talk about in the book, you see that there's no logical or necessary reason why they do have to be opposed to each other. In fact, you could argue that care, mutual care, mutual aid, is really what enables social freedoms as opposed to purely individual ones. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk about this in terms of, I mean, not to just concentrate on the Americas, because you certainly don't in this book. You range all over the world, but on Teotihuacan.
It's become a lot more central than we anticipated, the Americas. And a few people have said, well, why don't you talk more about sub-Saharan Africa or Oceania? And it's really true that we don't even attempt to give a balanced or a comprehensive appraisal of world history. The book is really oriented around a question which led us much deeper than we expected into the history of the Americas.
And that question is?
It started with a question about the origins of inequality. We were trying to understand, this is another part of the book that people seem to have perhaps misunderstood. I guess it's our fault. Maybe we didn't frame it clearly enough. Some people think that we're claiming that European societies before the colonial encounter with North America didn't have a concept of social equality or social inequality. It's clear that they did, and we actually give some examples of it from the Middle Ages, from Greco-Roman sources, from scriptural sources. But the question that we're really interested in at the start of the book is how a consensus formed among European intellectuals at a particular point in time around the middle of the 18th century, that if you imagined humanity with civilization stripped away, what would be left is a society of equals. The idea that there was this kind of universal primordial society of equals, which is necessary. It's necessary logically to have a view like that in order to then ask the question, what is the origin of social inequality? If you believe inequality was always there, it doesn't really make sense to ask that question. But that's exactly the question that intellectuals throughout Europe started puzzling over around that time. And we wanted to know why, because the societies they were living in at that time were anything but equal or egalitarian. They were generally monarchical, very hierarchical, highly ranked, highly unequal societies. So how did it become habitual for Europeans to assume that it had once been otherwise?
David Wengrow. There's more to our conversation about the dawn of everything after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on your podcast app. It really helps others to find the show. We're talking with David Wengrow about the dawn of everything. That's the book he co-authored with David Graeber that's upending the traditional view of human history. Just before the break, Wengrow was talking about how Enlightenment-era Europeans fixed on a narrative of the progression from so-called primitive society to civilization that concluded that the inequalities of civilization are the inevitable price of progress. And, you know, here, I think I'm actually quoting you here, just to go back to the indigenous view, you say equality was a direct consequence of individual liberty, and mutual aid was the necessary condition for individual autonomy. So they had no trouble putting those things together. And let's talk about it, you know, in terms of property, because, of course, inequality has very much to do with property. And yet you find the origins of property in ritual and play, you know, not in the kind of rigid, enforced cruelty that we really have in our society.
That's right. We talk about the origins of private property, and we talk about the standard view, if you like, that private property comes from agriculture, which is an idea that you can find all the way back at least to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. The idea that before agriculture, one had hunter-gatherer societies, which, if they had concepts of property at all, were just very sort of loose, and that agriculture is what brings private property into existence. Actually, as we show in the book, there's very little reason to believe that story. We could go into the details if you like, but they're not particularly relevant to the question you asked me, which was about how we instead then go about trying to think about the origins of private property. And we started by trying to define what we're talking about, because I think when people talk about the origins of property relations, they often don't really define what kind of property relations they're talking about. And as an anthropologist, David had written about many different varieties of forms of property relations that could exist. So what do we really mean when we talk about the origins of private property? If we look at what that means in our own societies, it's actually quite a peculiar thing in legal terms. Ownership of something in our European legal systems gives you rights over the thing, or originally even over the person, because this comes out of Greek and Roman law, where slavery was, of course, endemic. It was normal to have chattel slaves in one's house. It was the right of ownership that gave you the right to exert power over that thing, to dominate, to commodify it, to buy it, to sell it, to use it in any way you like. Whereas in other kinds of property systems, one finds much more of an emphasis on the obligation to care for and nurture what one owns as a consequence of owning it, as an expectation of being able to own it. So if we're looking for the origins of our own notion of private property, it occurred to us that there is a striking overlap between our understanding of what that is to own something and the notion of the sacred, the idea of something that almost has a kind of invisible force field around it. I think we give the example of a car. If you own a car, you have all sorts of restrictions on how you can use it. You know, you can't drive it above a certain speed, you can only park it in a certain sort of place. But one thing that you have absolute right to do is stop somebody else from getting inside it. And it's just one of many illustrations. You know, in some towns in England, you can hardly stop in the pavement without trespassing on somebody's private property. Because our idea of property has this exclusiveness around it, which in formal terms, it struck us is very, very similar to the idea of the sacred, to the idea of sacred things that can only be touched or seen by a certain authorized person or group. And actually, once we started looking through that kind of lens at the way that property relations work, including in societies that don't have coercive structures, how do you enforce property rights? Well, it's often precisely through religious taboos, and it's often only in the context of initiation ceremonies. We give the example of Australia, where Aboriginal groups that were otherwise very free and egalitarian would inflict these, well, still into recent times, it's very, very painful and rigorous kinds of initiation ceremonies on boys, on teenage boys, where they would gain access to certain kinds of sacred knowledge. They would become responsible for clan totems, which often take the form of images, which are linked to the use of land and resources. And in the process of this, they would have to go through numerous circumcision rituals, which are really extremely, very extreme, and follow orders. And it's that aspect of ritual, which is about hierarchy and taking orders, where we often find property rights exerted most explicitly in societies where otherwise they're not that important. So we started thinking about how this might work in the broader scheme of history, and wondering, you know, what kind of property relations might have existed in the Neolithic period or in the Paleolithic period. And one thing that's very clear is that agriculture has very little to do with it. There are many examples of hunter-gatherer societies that don't practice agriculture, but had highly developed concepts of private property. It's just that they were confined to very specific areas of life. So the question isn't so much what are the origins of private property, as how does it break out of those very particular forms of activity and come to condition so much of our lives in the way that we were talking about before, where if you think about it now, for most of us, property relations, we're dealing with them in smaller or larger ways every single day, almost on an hourly basis.
Yeah, and you know, what really strikes me is the way that the indigenous belief was that ownership implies care, whereas in this, the Western or the Roman and Greek belief is that ownership implies your license to destroy it.
Well, it's not, yeah, I'm not sure it's quite such a neat opposition. I think what you tend to get is a mixture of the two in most of the examples we give. For instance, you might have the idea that true ownership actually lies in the realm of the supernatural. So we give the example of Amazonian societies where everything, trees, mountains, almost anything you can see in nature is owned. It has a master, animal species, but this master will often be a spirit or an ancestor, which means that humans are either in the role, let's say if they're hunting a certain animal or picking a certain wild plant, they're either in the role of poachers, so they're stealing from the gods, or they may be in the role of caretakers, but they're never in the role of full owners who can take land and dispose of it as they please, because that resides with the gods, with the ancestors. So you have a mixture of this obligation to care and this obligation to compensate the spirits if you take away from what's theirs. What is peculiar about our Western legal traditions of property is that precisely that element of care seems to have been reduced to a minimum, almost so that it's not there at all. It comes up in my field of archaeology and anthropology often in relation to museums. You know, you often hear the example that museums that contain a lot of indigenous artifacts or ancient artifacts, they justify that on the basis that they care for them. But what does that mean? It's a bit paradoxical. For example, in countries like New Zealand, museums have had to accommodate completely different notions of what it means to own something. It doesn't necessarily give you the right to display it in a glass case. There may be issues of custodianship and caretaking. It doesn't necessarily give you the right to sell it, turn it into a commodity. And actually, in New Zealand, I think they've had quite a high degree of success in negotiating with indigenous groups and stakeholders and introducing those other more custodial concepts of ownership into the practice of curating artifacts, which is interesting because it gives you a slightly more complex view than, you know, the debates one often hears about, I own it, now we have to give it back, which implies that there's somebody at the other end who has exactly the same notion of property that you do.
You know, another area, I mean, you've mentioned agriculture here, and, you know, the kind of the Western notion that agriculture is a more highly developed form of society than foraging, which I think you demolish that argument in the book, The Dawn of Everything, David Wengrow. But that also goes with cities. You know, the idea that cities are in advance, and with cities you necessarily then have the beginning of inequality. I mean, I remember reading from, you know, Marx and Engels, you know, once you have a surplus, uh-huh. then you have the development of classes, and then you uh-huh. have the development of inequality. But talk about Teotihuacan, the creation of social housing, and really a kind of democratic, almost anarchic horizontalism.
Yeah, this was interesting. It's anticipated in the work of an art historian called Esther Pastori, who I think was an American of Hungarian origin. And she studied the art of this ancient city of Teotihuacan, which is in the Valley of Mexico, not that far from Mexico City. And she noticed something intriguing. Teotihuacan is full of art. It's full of images, sculptures, and little terracotta images. There's pictures everywhere, thousands of them. But nowhere could she find pictures of people dominating each other. And if you're familiar with the artistic traditions of neighboring civilizations, earlier and later ones, like the Olmec of the Gulf Coast, or the classic Maya of Yucatan, or the Zapotec, you know that they're full of these images of kings, dynastic rulers, and warrior champions bashing their enemies in various ways, dominating them, tying them up, making them play horrible ball games, and then killing them ritually. None of this could she find at Teotihuacan, and she actually thought of it as an anti-authoritarian civilization, almost a kind of utopian experiment, she calls it, in a more egalitarian form of life. And her views were widely published, and I think probably fell out of fashion or out of favor, as things do in academia. But over the last, so she was writing mostly in the 1970s and 80s. Over the last 10 years, they've really come back through some much more rigorous, including statistical archaeological analyses of levels of wealth inequality at Teotihuacan, which really show that in the later phases of the city, they do seem to have managed to create an urban civilization, multi-ethnic. We know there were groups there from all over the place, different language groups from Chiapas, from the Maya lowlands, from the Gulf Coast, big multi-ethnic population of perhaps 100,000 people, I think is the latest conservative estimate, where almost everyone seems to have had a very high standard of living in very spacious, well-furnished apartment blocks. I think roughly the size, I think each block is roughly, each compound is, well, compound is a very bad word. Compound doesn't sound nice, does it? But these are lovely buildings. They've got lovely plastered walls. They're more like luxury villas. And each one is something like 2,000 square meters. And within it are three or perhaps four family apartments, family residences, grouped around a courtyard. Archaeologists can reconstruct what they were eating, their standard of living, and for the most part, it was extremely good. It wasn't complete equality. Some of these apartments are nicer and larger than others, But very few people seem to have fallen through the cracks. Almost everyone in the city, for hundreds of years, seems to have had a superb standard of living. And it's particularly fascinating because if you go to Teotihuacan, which I had been planning to do with David Graeber before COVID, we were going to go to Mexico and actually see some of these places we'd never seen before, except in books. But if you look at pictures of Teotihuacan, what do you see? You see the pyramids, the Pyramid of the Sun, the Pyramid of the Moon, the Great Temple of the Feathered Serpent, the Avenue of the Dead. These are all names that the Aztec gave to the monuments, by the way. We don't actually know what language the majority of people spoke at Teotihuacan. It's thought that they had a writing system, but it can't really be read as yet. So what about the pyramids? Well, they belong to the first phase of the city's existence. And for about two centuries, people were clearly doing something else, something much more focused on the center, something much more hierarchical. There are actually burials of humans who were ritually killed under the foundations of those great monuments. Also interesting is that at a certain point, all of that stops. In real terms, it's around the year 300 AD. They close off the Temple of the Feathered Serpent and desecrate it. There's no more pyramid building. And that's when you get the redirection of the city's resources into something much more collective, much more to the benefit of the great majority of citizens, rather than just a small elite.
And multi-ethnic. And that's a perfect segue, actually, to my last question, which is because it's really kind of, it's about a revolution of a kind. You know, you and David Graeber ask in The Dawn of Everything, how inevitable are the types of governments we have today? And I think you pretty convincingly answer, there's nothing inevitable about it. But how do we get out of the trap we're in? It just seems that we are under the thumb of, you know, what I call predatory late capitalism, that just its grip, its death grip on our societies and on our, indeed, on our planet, on our ecosystems is just implacable.
Well, you've reached, you know, you've made an analysis and you've reached a conclusion. And I think that has to be the first step. But you're going to get pushback, and some of that pushback will be in the form of arguments that what we have now is in fact the result of thousands of years of social evolution, and that while we may be able to change things in a fairly minor way, the kind of systems we have now are basically inevitable. They're preordained by history. This is the theory of the origins of the state, which looks all the way back to ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia for the roots of our present forms of government. And one of the things we try to show in the book is that this whole approach is basically wrong. I mean, it just doesn't work on a logical or conceptual plane, and it doesn't fit any of the evidence that we have. And I think simply realizing that the systems we have are very recent in origin. In some ways, they're quite arbitrary. We talk about the way that modern states involve three basic institutional components or factors. There's sovereignty. There's always some form of administration or central control over information, knowledge. And then there's what we generally call politics, which for us means elections in a kind of sports-like way where politicians get up and compete for votes and compete for followers, and you have winners and you have losers. And what we show in the book is that actually there's nothing particularly necessary or coherent about that combination of things. Each of those three things, sovereignty, administration, and charismatic politics, if you like, have totally different histories, stretching back as far as we can take the evidence. And I think simply realizing that allows you to ask different kind of procedural questions. You know, here we just had the climate summit, which is debating something indisputably of relevance to everybody on the planet. You know, if ever there was a large-scale, long-term issue, it's climate change. And yet the people doing most of the talking and the decision-making are politicians. They're thinking about the short term. They're thinking about voters. They're thinking about the next election. Why do we do it that way? Well, people are already experimenting with other ways of doing it, assembling local assemblies on a random basis, cross-section of a local population that will get together and think about what it needs to do to change its carbon footprint. I mean, it's just one example, but I think partly what we're doing in the book is really trying to counter some of these factually incorrect, basically mythological notions of history that lead us to believe that we can't do those things, that there's some kind of inexorable force of history or social evolution that prevents us from even trying.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. You're listening to my conversation with David Wengrow about the book he co-authored with David Graeber, The Dawn of Everything. Exactly. And of course, that's at the service of the tiny elite. You know, I wanted to ask you a more personal question, which is that, you know, you wrote this really deeply researched, deep dive into, you know, the history, the alternative, the new history of humanity with someone who died before it even could come to publication. Is that right?
Yeah, there's nothing good about the whole situation, but it is a small saving grace that we did complete an entire draft of the book, including the conclusion, just a few weeks before David passed away.
So I just wanted to ask you, kind of in honor of him, what was it like to work together, to do a kind of a collaboration here?
It was really the greatest pleasure of my my academic career and also personally. He was just an incredibly enchanting, funny, brilliant guy, and we had a whale of a time writing this, and we're both knowledge junkies, and nothing gives us more pleasure than diving into obscure academic archives and that sort of thing. And we just agreed very early on that this would be a fun project, that we'd do it really in a spirit of fun and play. We wouldn't set deadlines. We would never pressure each other. We both did numerous other projects, you know, in between the 10 or 11 years that we worked on the book. And as long as we maintained that sort of ethos, there really weren't many difficult moments, I have to say, which is why we actually felt terribly depressed when we finished. We thought, oh no, we'll have to immediately start working on sequels. I think David wanted to write at least three more books.
What did he want to write?
We didn't ever really decide, actually, because it was so much fun. I think we just had to agree that we would write more. That was the important thing, is that we wouldn't stop. But we never got so far as coming up with a scheme of what each book would cover. It's become pretty obvious to me that, particularly doing interviews and reading reviews of the book, that the things that we would need to enlarge on would be this question of how we got stuck, if you like, how societies lost those basic freedoms that you and I started off talking about, which we do go into, and we do offer some fairly clear pointers, I think, as to how we think that happened in many cases. But I can see that readers want more in terms of explanation, and I suspect that's where we would have gone.
And do you think you might do that on your own or with a new collaborator?
Oh, I don't know, Francesca. It's too soon to say.
Well, it is a very important book, The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. It really gives us a sense that not only is another world possible, but other possible worlds of many, many kinds have been invented by human beings since time immemorial. David Wengrow, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about this wonderful book.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I have one other question, but it doesn't have to take a long answer. How can you figure out how people lived from ruins that are, I mean, the really ancient ones, you go way back in, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. How do you guys know this stuff?
Well, you should come and do a degree with us at the Institute of Archaeology. This is how we roll. This is what we teach our students.
I see. God, it's, I just kept on thinking, how do they know this?
Well, you do it. You interpret it to the best of your knowledge, to the best of your ability. And it's partly about understanding what you don't know and being able to filter out, you know, the likelihoods from the less likely things, and also understand where the gaps are. This is why it becomes very quickly problematic when people who aren't trained in archaeology start dabbling in it, because they don't really understand what they're looking at and they don't understand how it got there. You know, the archaeological record is not really what people think it is. What you're seeing is very, very rarely an accurate reflection of what anybody was doing. It's a kind of, you know, it's altered by thousands of years of environmental change and weathering. And you have to be able to weed out a lot of extraneous information to actually make an archaeological interpretation that's viable. So what we try and do in the book is cut through a lot of that procedural stuff and give the reader a clear sense of what we feel was the most likely reconstruction.
Hmm. Well, it's great. And, you know, you also have to examine, you have to weed out your own biases too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is like first year stuff that we get students thinking about is how to avoid imposing one's own assumptions on a body of information.
Oh, well, thank you for that. And thank you so much for a terrific interview.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
David Wengrow. You can hear an audio excerpt from The Dawn of Everything by going to writersvoice.net. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with conservation biologist Thor Hansen about his book, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, the fraught and fascinating biology of climate change. Also, evolutionary biologist Beth Shapiro tells us about her book, Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.